Here. Okay. After university, then, you moved on to a job with the Canadian Maritime Commission. What years did you work for the Canadian Maritime Commission?
I started with the Maritime Commission in 1948.
And tell me a little bit about how the Maritime Commission was established. What was it? What was its goal?
It took over various departments that had been in the Department of Transport. Basically, during wartime in Canada, there were about 400 vessels built in Canada in the shipyards here. They included many of the workers that we had in our shipyards and brand new shipyards like United in Montreal were workers that came from the United Kingdom, from North Shields and other thing here, to help build, because to build vessels in the United Kingdom was not a very practical thing with the bombing going on in shipyards. It's hard for anybody today in our age to believe that in that time, having that many vessels built in Canada. About 300 of them were 10,000-ton cargo vessels. The design for these vessels came from a shipyard in England, in North Shields. Half of them were coal burners and half of them were oil burners. One of them were named after all the forts in Canada, and the other was named after all of parks, national parks in Canada. And they were operated under a government-established company called Park Steamship. There was wartime shipbuilding, which was a corporation, Park Steamship, and other Crown corporations looking after the cargo or the travel of the vessels. Some of these vessels were lost during the war. But after, the Maritime Commission had the role of finding what the country should do with these vessels. We'd had prior experience, Canada had a prior experience after the First World War of having vessels. And it lasted for a number of years, but was not a very successful thing, operation. The Maritime Commission under the chairmanship of Mr. Klein, Justice Klein of British Columbia, came up with a plan of selling these vessels to Canadian owners or Canadian companies that were operated in maritime shipping. Most of them, if not all of them, had been agents for foreign companies operating vessels to and from Canada, operating vessels on different services from Canada to the Mediterranean, to the Caribbean, predominantly to the United Kingdom. So these companies really had not operated vessels, but certainly were familiar with the owners in Europe and about the types of cargo that were received and shipped prior to the war.
Did the commission sort of dismantling the fleet and spreading it out to various companies, did that have any impact on the grain export industry in Canada?
Perhaps a little later. So these companies were It was agreed to sell them to these various companies. There was a big demand for cargo vessels for commercial trade, because there's nothing had been built in the past 10 years during the war. So the Canadian Maritime Commission was able to obtain from these owners for every vessel the exact cost of what those ships had cost Canada to build during the wartime. They were worth that. So, but subsequently, the owners had difficulties in finding cargo, and found that operating from Canada was very expensive. So they then came to the government to ask for assistance. At that time, the conflict in Korea came about, and there was an immediate demand for cargo vessels. So companies then, other owners of vessels that were in that trade were looking for cargo vessels. So under Mr. Klein's guidance, the government approved of a replacement program so that the Canadian owners could sell these vessels. In most cases, they received more than what they paid for, but one of the conditions they had if they sold was to place the entire proceeds in an escrow fund. And most of the vessels were sold under, and the money put in an escrow fund. And they could receive those funds provided they built vessels or added to the maritime industry within Canada. The main beneficiary of this at the time was building of lake vessels, replacing the Canadian fleet of lake vessels. Many of them had been very old and other things.
When would they have originally been built, most of those ships in the lake vessel fleet?
Oh, they were very small. Most of them were canalers, the only ones that were canalers. Some were imported from the United States. One fleet in particular, Patterson Steamship, had many vessels that had been built, operated on the lakes. Some, a few, even though they were small, came from overseas. Some of them had been barges that had been towing sand or other cargoes, and then were converted with put motors in them. They were towed with tugs prior to that. Some came from overseas, some were imported from the States, and some built in Canada. Mm-hmm. But all that could navigate from the St. Lawrence into the Great Lakes, the largest size of them was a vessel about 25, could transport 2,500 tons. They were limited the size of the locks and everything else like that, but they were very successful. There were some larger lakers that in the case of grain could load grain and transport it to the ports like Sarnia, at Port Colborne, Toronto, Kingston, or Prescott. And then that grain was unloaded and reloaded in canalers that brought it to the St. Lawrence. Following that, at about the same time, there was plans that were well advanced of building the St. Lawrence Seaway. And the seaway was built in great place to having dams for hydroelectric power, and the seaway was built to circumvent the dams, just as the Welland Canal had been built to circumvent the Niagara Falls. So So the seaway was really opened up the trade, and it was completed and opened in the spring, on the opening of navigation in 1959.
And was that, were you on one of the ships that was the first through the seaway?
It was quite a story, as you can imagine, with many owners, prominent owners of vessels, so Canada Steamship Lines and Meisner Steamship in Upper Lakes and Patterson, at, influential, how they would, which would be the first vessels to cross the, from the Great Lakes to the St. Lawrence and vice versa. So there was discussion about this, not in the press, but in the maritime circles all the winter. And a week before the seaway was opened, the Seaway Authority announced the first vessel that they would allow in. Very wisely on their part, there was a vessel owned by Mohawk Navigation called the Mohawk Deer that had loaded grain at Thunder Bay for winter cargo storage, and it had got come down as far as Prescott. And in the St. Lawrence, they chose a canaler that had been the first one to lay up in Montreal, waiting to go back into the lake at the Simcoe. I recall the Simcoe because the day it belonged to Canada Steamship Lines, and as I drove by in the morning in the automobile, I saw a big crew on board the vessel. And later that day, when I drove on my way home, the vessel had been painted from the stem to the stern. It was the first vessel. And I dare say I was happy to be, I was on the Simcoe, on its way up in the canal. It was the first vessel to transit. And the owner of the Mohawk Deer asked to have his wheat board to change his contract instead of just the Prescott, whether he could proceed down to the St. Lawrence, which he did, and that was the first vessel that came through the seaway on its way down.
What were your thoughts as you went through the seaway on that ship?
Oh, we just went through a few locks on the way down, because that's quite a long day at that time, ceremony. We went through the St. Lambert lock and up to Beauharnois. Interesting, at Beauharnois, it was a major lock, the two locks, circumventing a major hydroelectric power dam.
So back to your work with the commission. I understand that you did a fair bit of work on cataloging the ships that were available and their history. tell us a bit about the kind of work you did.
Yeah, other than my work at the Maritime Commission, I was in traffic and economics. And at the time, there were quite often questions in the House of actually how many ships had been built. And there had been different answers. So I undertook to see if we could find out. And I dealt with people from wartime shipbuilding and the various government departments that were involved at that time, access at their records. And the basis, I certainly found out that when authorization was given to build a certain vessel, it would take at least 6 months prior to the building of the vessel, and they would give a number that would be put on the keel of the vessel, as all the building starts from a keel. But in studying, I found out, though they had ordered vessels, then a priority would change. They wouldn't cancel that number, but they'd decide to build another type of vessel in the yard, And so there were a lot more keel numbers than there were vessels built. But I did get a record by every shipyard, and that I've kept from the day they started building, how many days it took to build, the cost of building, and of course the name of the ship itself. And then followed that subsequently, got a record of those that had been lost, either by aircraft or submarines, and subsequently kept track of those when they were sold, the new name and the new owners of the vessels.
Where are those records kept?
I had put a lot of work in, and I had typed out, along with the history of the merchant marine in the First World War and that, a detailed record, and I had typed all of that, so I kept it myself. And over the years, I received a number of inquiries from officials in Ottawa, inquiring a background of certain companies.
So we continue from there?
Yeah, where were
we? I was just asking you about where copies of your records you have were held.
So a number of... Up until this time, a number of years ago, at the Remembrance Day ceremonies here, I met merchant seamen. And in conversation, they were amazed when I had asked them what vessel that they were on, and told them that I had a record of these vessels. They told me then that there was a group in Vancouver that had started a museum and keeping of records. They arranged for me to be in communication with them, and they now have a copy of that in the museum in Vancouver. And some of those seamen that are still here in Winnipeg asked me for a copy that they wanted to leave for their grandchildren.
And you have your own copy?
Yes, I have the original copy.
I understand that when you worked with the Maritime Commission, you had an opportunity to spend some time with Canada's major railways. Tell me a little about that, and did it give you any insight into the transporting of grain across Canada?
Well, with this replacement program, this escrow fund, I think first, the owners that had received money and had sold their ship, had the money in escrow, investigated what possibilities of investing in Canadian shipping. And that's how the Lake Fleet was built. Companies like General Electric and Westinghouse that built big motors, marine engines, and that started the building of the... So the first money was used to build Lakers. I think among the first were Canada Steamship Lines. They had their own shipyards, of course, or associated shipyards. And they built vessels. There was a Sir James Dunn, the Coverdale, the Hochelaga. Those vessels at that time were about 15 to 16,000 tons compared to the prior to the war, and subsequently bigger vessels were built, maximum size, once that the... So literally all of that money was used to rebuild the Canadian fleet along the Great Lakes, which was then built to the capacity of docks for unloading ore, and were able to proceed down to the St. Lawrence. And so all of that money, so the owners got back their money, those that had the funds at the beginning. Then they sold the escrow funds to others, and out of that they made 20% or 25%. But the whole replacement program was out of that those funds. So Mr. Klein, who really headed that program of the replacement Klein, left the commission in in 1950, I'd been at to return out to British Columbia. He was appointed to the Supreme Court at that time in his country, in British Columbia. At that time, there was an emergency in export trade in Canada. There had been no export, really, other than for the wartime goods to the United Kingdom and that. But a big demand was beginning. And so there was a need for transportation within Canada, particularly railways. There was the steel companies and every other product, and asking in Parliament and getting a lot of publicity. So the government appointed a transport controller, a Mr. R.W. Milner, who's from Western Canada, who had a major role in the development of the grain industry in Western Canada, and certainly very knowledgeable. And the grain industry was one of the facing a heavy demand for rail cars, when you consider there was over 5,000 country elevators, each one of them requiring a boxcar at that time. So Mr. Milner was then, took over Mr. Klein's office and the chairman's office at the Maritime Commission. And so I was in the staff of the traffic and that. We were seconded to his office.
And what was the name of that office, Mr. Milner's office?
The Transport Controller of Canada. Just looking at the transportation, including pulpwood along the St. Lawrence, or coal, particularly iron ore with the other companies, many bulk products, but the big one was grain as well. In time, he asked me if I would join his staff, and asked me to move to Montreal, to an office in Montreal. The center of transportation, ocean transportation, maritime transportation in Eastern Canada at that time was in Montreal.
So your previous job then with the Maritime Commission was in Ottawa?
Yeah, there was still, I was still the Maritime Commission, and he was the chairman, he was down the hall. Started with that and then moved on to Montreal at that. There were grain forwarders, vessel agents, longshoremen, all the export trade, import trade, and naturally the both railways had head offices in Montreal. There was a lot to learn, but it was very, very interesting. And during the winter, when there was less traffic on, certainly nothing across the Great Lakes and that, I was interested in learning more of the main departments. One winter for over a month and a half, I was invited at Canadian Pacific Railway's head office to the office of the Chief of Transportation. And each morning, the working morning, in his office would be the Vice President of Operations and his secretary, the Chief of Transportation, myself. And they would go over the whole system from the Pacific Coast to the in Trail BC, the pulp and paper industry, and key to that all was the motive power. And then always planning months ahead of like when the grain industry, when the farmers were seeding, then the deliveries would fall down of grain, then they would rise on the crops. And I was very quiet, but I listened as much as possible and learned a great deal from them, and certainly the language of the railway and their terminology. And then subsequently, I spent a month in the similar office of the Canadian National Railway. I spent a lot of time in the port warden's office in Montreal, and the harbor, briefly in the harbor master's office, and working and the port warden's office was very interesting. The port warden, important job of when vessels do come in and load cargo, they must approve the plans of loading, what cargo is going to be loaded. And they follow up, and a ship cannot sail unless they approve that the plans have been followed precisely. But in that office, they had the load lines, the depth of each vessel. So on behalf of the Seaway, I got a record of the depth that the ships had loaded and sailed on for the previous 5 years, to see which of these companies and vessels could proceed up the Seaway once the Seaway opened. And so I worked very closely with the economic and staff at the Maritime Commission, at the St. Lawrence Seaway. Dr. Camus, who was doing that work, he subsequently became chairman of the Maritime Commission in time. And
when you think back on your time with the Maritime Commission and the Transport Controller's Office, are there any stories that stick in your mind?
Oh, no, not at the moment that I can think of.
No.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah. When you were making the step to your next part in the career, in your career, what would you say your view of the Canadian grain industry was after your time in Montreal? What before you worked with the Canadian Wheat Board?
The next stage in my career was that the main cargoes coming down was the Canadian Wheat Board or the cargo. So from that, my only story was that during wartime. But what Mr. Milner recommended, I went out west, and I were at a busy time of the year. I worked in a country elevator for a week, saw them how they received grain cars, how they were ordered, how there was the grain dooring of the cars, lining of the cars, then the loading, the records of the loading of the cars, dispatching the between the railway and the grain people. So that was a good, get some knowledge about that field of it. And subsequently, the Canadian Wheat Board hired me to open an office in Montreal. And from that office, all documentation as a vessel would load, it had a series of documentation that it had to have for the overseas buyer to receive, that the buyer had to send overseas. So all of that work was done in Montreal, covering shipments out of the port of Churchill, out of the port of Halifax and St. John in the winter, and all St. Lawrence ports, as well at that time any exports from the Great Lakes. So that was my first knowledge then of about Port Churchill and other ports. I was in Montreal for quite a few years, 5 years before opening the CUA and 5 years after. So saw the development, the change in the terminals in the St. Lawrence, the new terminals that came about. And then most winters I did at least one visit down to Halifax and to St. John to be familiar with that trade.
So you mentioned the changes in the terminals over that about 10-year period. What caused those changes and what changes did you see?
Well, they were very clever in the St. Lawrence because all of the equipment, unloading and receiving equipment, was made for unloading canalers that had cargoes of 2,500 tons. 2,500 tons is 93,000 bushels. So to change all of that was just out of...
It just
wasn't possible. All the belting, all the facilities, the openings.
To change it to handle larger ships.
Volume of grain. Receiving it and on belts and the scales and all of that. So they were very clever, the companies. They built an addition to the elevator. A big annex that had bigger openings, bigger tanks. And so the flow then was divided as it came in. The belts, what they were, it's hard to change the whole belting and all. So by building annexes, they had the two different flows coming in off the vessel. But it also gave them additional fertility.
And what created the need for this additional capacity?
Well, prior to that, they unloaded canalers for 2,500 tons. But now we were getting them with 20,000 tons and 15,000 tons. So big additions were put in, separate at Sorel, at Three Rivers, a major, they had a big storage, they had a facility that could hold, one big storage facility that held about 750,000 tons. And then Quebec, and then in time, brand new elevators were built. Cargill grain opened what at Baie-Comeau, and then further down the line, there was a big terminal built at Port Cartier, which then were very helpful over the years.
So you started with the wheat board in Montreal in around what time? Mid-50s?
The flow, it went from one to the other.
Yeah.
In the mid-50s. Yeah.
Mid-50s. And what, describe your job there. What was your job with the wheat board? Maybe before you do that, let's step back a bit. What caused the wheat board to need to open an office on the St. Lawrence? Because is most of the work done... in the West?
Well, as I said, there had been no exports at all during the commercial exports from 1938 to 1939 until that time.
So the government handled all
the trade had changed dramatically at that time. During the war, they had been given the role of doing the shipping rather than the firms. Shipping grain from Western Canada, they were even given responsibility for Ontario wheat. And all it was shipping Western grain to flour mills and keeping track. There was no export, per se. So...
But after the war, that changed. So the need for the...
Yes. And for them to get knowledge of that field. I was there, or they would hire somebody from other firms. So they hired me to open the office in Montreal, start the office up.
And describe a little bit about your work there at that time.
Oh. You know, in addition to the export trade, there was a heavy domestic trade. We had the big flour mills in Montreal were there. Canada Malting and Dominion Malting, which were for the brewing industries of the distilleries, they took part of the elevators and the shipping, and they had to be protected. Then there were feed grains, a large part of the feed grains, that as more and more growers are raising cattle and hogs and everything in Quebec, came out of the elevator. As a matter of fact, all during the shipping season, but before the close of starting in the fall, we had to reduce our stocks in Montreal elevator almost to nothing, because they had urgent that they had domestic trade have their supplies for the whole winter. So the office in Montreal was predominantly to keep track of the stocks into the elevators in and out each day, what was shipped out and what was taken in by vessels. And then as ocean directing lakers, the lake vessels could unload at any one terminal, but they were interested in getting unloaded as quickly as possible. So waiting till they were in the seaway to say that they could go to Sorel or to Three Rivers. And then ocean boats, we would get the first reports from agents when they were arriving, and then directing them, recommending to Winnipeg, who would then have to tell the exporter, send your boat to Three Rivers, who would tell a vessel agent in Montreal, and to get the stevedoring companies. It was a
sophisticated planning process.
Yeah, it took some to learn, but to coordinate. But it, and then the essential that the business of each company be kept absolutely, to be very discreet with that. Yeah,
and fair.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Certain elevators, like in Three Rivers, they belong to Upper Lakes in Toronto. Naturally, they would like to handle their own vessels at the cost of unloading and that. And Beaconsfield and Mohawk owned a Sorel elevator. And then some that were part export and part domestic on the vessels. So it was a trying to be very fair to everybody, and it was to our advantage to get the vessel turned out as quickly as possible. And most of them, that was not their main trade. They weren't built for transporting grain. Each one of them had a trade, important trade of their own.
Such as?
Salt, a lot of pulpwood. But the ore company, the amount of ore and coal. And so these, the grain were return cargoes often. And so knowing that trade, you went along with what they had and to their advantage. Basically, how we could turn the vessel, the fleets around as quickly as possible.
So when you think back on your time, you know, especially the early years with your work there, did you... what's the word I'm looking for? Did you have a new appreciation for the complexity of the grain industry in Canada?
Well, every day was a new day. I would learn something. Again, from the railways, one very important part, there were liner companies, that is vessels on regular service, that advertise the liner service. There must have been a minimum of 8 or 9 liner companies with regular sailings to the United Kingdom. And all of them came to Montreal with import cargo and would load export cargo, often only 2,000 tons of grain, 2,500 tons of grain, going to Manchester, going to Glasgow, going to the Bristol Channel, going to Newcastle, on a regular basis for millers at that company. For example, few thought that the large passenger vessels that the Canadian Pacific had, the Empresses, they came into, and all of those came into Montreal, had a regular berth. So there were two elevators to load to make sure that they didn't have to move while they were there. The Empress had a forward hold that could load up to 1,500 tons of cargo. There was one particular miller in Liverpool that Tabasa had cargo almost on each one of them. And the rest of the hold was with mail from Canada. There was no airlines at that time for package mail and everything else like that.
So these liners heading over to Britain were carrying little packets of grain in part of their hold.
Oh yes, Manchester Lines, Ellerman, Wilson, you know, Donaldson Line, the Cunard had the Canadian Pacific, other than the passenger, had their own fleet. They were named the Beaver Cove, the Beaver Lodge, the Beaver Ford, the cargo vessels. So there were many trying to service them, each one of them, as quick as possible.
Was it a big office, the Canadian Wheat Board office at that time in Montreal?
It was myself and two chaps keeping records and a secretary, a girl in the office. But the forwarding agents that represented different companies, there were a number of them. In Montreal, the grain companies, the exporters didn't have offices themselves, but they hired exporters. So there were about four or five of those offices. They brought us records every day of what was going on. Because as they needed to deliver grain out there. Very interesting. As I say, I learned every day.
Yeah.
And the longshoremen were interested in where the ship was going to load, because they had to send people to supervise it. Yeah.
I'll ask the same question as I asked before. Are there any particular stories that sort of stand out in your mind?
I have to leave that another time. There were so many that
we'll have a separate tape on stories.
Oh, yeah. So... The chief harbor master, Captain Dufour, which was a real character, he was in charge of all the traffic in the port. No ship could move. That's why there's no accidents. You can imagine.
Like an air traffic controller.
Absolutely. They can't move. So but all the cargo, the liners moving out with tugs. So he was in the middle of the elevator. His office was in the middle of the harbor. There were two major elevators, and all of these liners would be there. And as far as he was concerned, the Lakers unloaded. All they were when he saw me, he called me grain dust. Yeah, and they have a heavy French accent, because I understood him. So he'd hear from an agent, what berth were they called, about getting the grain. And sometimes he'd tell him, call grain dust. But he was a master over the whole port, very essential, where no tugs, no movement can be on. And, but his view was off because anyways.
Your next career step then required you to make quite a move. When did that happen, and how did it happen?
Well, some people retired at the Canadian Wheat Board that had been around a lot and changes, I guess. And then
Winnipeg?
Yeah. And in 63, they asked me if I would come to Winnipeg, which I did. That was quite a move with a rather young family of five and everything, and with all the family connections in the East, but I came to Western Canada, to Winnipeg. And at the beginning, I was involved in the shipments via Eastern Canada, booking lake freight contracts with lake operators and different companies and loading their vessels. And that's our first knowledge about Thunder Bay, dealing with the lake shippers and with the... And then I moved up into the sales department. But as I often people tell people, we don't sell, it's people that buy grain. So how we can accommodate the buyers and the exporters are more than that. And they, but in the press and media, they like to say we sold so much and this and that.
So what would a typical day in the sales department of Canadian Wheat Board look like? At that time when you were new kid on the block?
We start by late after the after the close of the market, the Winnipeg Grain Exchange. We didn't trade, but we were on the floor because exporters' representatives were on the floor. They're handling oats and barley, and particularly flax for overseas. So the market closed at... say 1:15 or 1:30, and I guess the procedure these firms would wire the closing markets prices to their office either in New York or in London that we're doing business at. But then they would ask us before the close, what did we have to offer, or how was there any wheat or something they were asked to offer? We'd say yes, you could after overnight. Good to the following morning at 8 o'clock. So the next morning we would hear from some that they would book so much wheat. They would ask what periods and what amount wheat. So they could put the offer of freight and money and to make an offer to buyers.
What do you mean by periods? What periods?
Well, we didn't want to sell wheat 6 months ahead of time, and we didn't sure we had it in the country elevators. One thing we were told, never offer what you don't have, and that's what happens. And, yeah, a certain shipping period, and none of them were sticking their head out too far ahead anyways, but say 60 days or 90 days ahead, because they'd have to get freight. They get the money, the freight, the value of the money at the time before they make an offer to the buyer who accepts, say, I'll take that 2,500 tons or 10,000 tons.
You moved from the Eastern Wheat Board service into the Western one. What would be, say, the biggest changes that any
well,
eye-opening...
Well, one of them wasn't big. You can imagine me coming from Montreal and a bunch of staff over here, and then say, that was something else, the whole new world. And then really most of them were very good in their work, but had no idea about shipping. Because basically the wheat board, everything stopped at Thunder Bay, or to the grain companies in Western Canada.
And why was that?
All of the credit, the people that buy grain in Western Canada, into Elevate, they ship it to Thunder Bay, then they get paid for it. And the wheat board has title. So these companies here have no interest in what happens to it there, other than it's in their terminal they want it safe. Then when it's shipped east, like Canada Steamship Lines, and come say, we have such a vessel, can we take it? We say yes. They tell us, well, give it to Richardson. They say that Richardson will put a, it's going to be the shipper, the lake vessel tell. And Richardson then calls us, what are you going to load? So much. And they pay us money, value of the grain, as if they were shipping. And then they ship it from there to wherever it's unloaded in the St. Lawrence. All along the line, it's a financial thing. When the grain moves from a farmer to a country elevator, then it changes hands, it belongs to the elevator, and then when it's into a car, at each stage, and there are different titles to the grain and all that.
So in the car belongs to the railways?
Yep. If it's derailed, they come, they pay us for the bill of lading quantity and the price of the grain at Thunder Bay.
And when does the wheat board lose ownership of it? Or does it ever?
They get it at Thunder Bay, at Vancouver, in Store Churchill. When it's in the store at the terminal at the in the St. Lawrence, the lake shipper, the agent that was on a vessel. So that's how Canada steamshipper Meisner encouraged customers to ship their own grain on it, like flax and rapeseed and other businesses. They would give them this lake freight and they ship it finance, but they made some money at that doing that, huh?
And when do the customers pay for it?
What customers now?
The wheat board's customers.
Yeah, you're getting to a different... And which way the wheat board customer?
Well, the people that you're exporting to...
Once it's in Montreal elevators at St. Lawrence Terminal, it's held by these different agents in our name. They cannot deliver the grain to a ship until we get paid in Winnipeg. So once a ship comes in, say that the shipper is Dreyfus, Jean-Michel, he pays Winnipeg in Winnipeg here. We then order Richardson, that has the grain title of grain in Montreal, to deliver to the office of Dreyfus in Montreal the documents. And then Dreyfus's agent goes to the harbor board and orders the loading in the ship. But not a grain goes out of the spout until it's paid.
Which raises the question in my mind. I'm thinking now that all of this kind of record transaction is all dealt with by computer. But back in those early years, how were things communicated? How did this paper get... moved around in a, or this data get moved around in a
amazing,
some kind of timely
amazing
fashion.
Yeah, yeah. So the number of people, and then and the reliability on people.
Right. So how did it move? Like special couriers?
Oh, well, then you're asking.
Telegraph.
Huh?
Too big a story for today.
Pardon?
Too big a story for today?
Yeah.
Why don't we just call it...
Stop here and I'll show you. Just.
So let me just sort of update the recording here and say that we'll do this another time. Just continuing our conversation, and it's obvious to me that we need to spend more time on the whole communications issue in the grain trade. Because of the changes over time and the fact that this was communication right around the world. So we've agreed to leave that for another discussion and just continue on now with a couple of sort of general questions about your career in Winnipeg. So just take a couple of seconds to, or as long as you like, to just think for a moment about what would you like people to know most about the work you did during this part of your career? You can go right back to the beginning if you want, but I think I'm thinking mostly about your work with the wheat board. What would you like people to know most about that work?
Oh, really, I was part of a teamwork, I guess. And I was interested and to be a team worker, I got to replace some of the other people over the years, or some that somebody would retire and another appointment would come in. And often some were put in my office to follow up. And I did want to make sure that in the event something happened to me or to some of the chaps in my office on our travels or on some other things, that some of the work was postponed on. So I really had not a big team, but a very key staff since I had to leave the city quite often. And what was interesting were employees that had been at the board prior to that, and then that the computer area came along and others. And they were sort of pushed aside. They didn't have their, not pushed aside, but they didn't have that state. They were there long. So I had about three or four young chaps that worked at there. Maybe they had a few years before retirement, but that they were very, very good. They were discreet, and because we had the work before of different firms.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really, when I was a general sales manager, at the moment we had what each company was a separate desk, but I had a pretty good idea what they were doing and who they dealt with overseas. And never have I given that out. And the companies knew that from me. And they never heard a report. Compared to today, what their positions were.
Their positions as in their financial positions?
What they had a position, whether they were long or short the market overnight. And having been in Montreal and in the freight business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay.
So if you think back, and this might be a tough question to answer, but, you know, think back to, you know, the beginning of our conversation where your first experience with the Western grain trade was working on a, stooking grain on a farm. And now as you look back on what you know about the grain industry beyond stooking grain, what are your thoughts about Canada's grain industry?
Oh, that's quite a question to ask. I learned there were a lot of good people, yeah. A lot of, if you had good reputations and the floor very, very good. And a big change was like in my time, it all happened at that period. First of all was the change in the metric system. And none of them could have a certain age, and everything was done in bushels and everything else like that they could have dreamt that they had. And they made representation of politicians, and they were left under the impression, well, this is talked about, but I don't think it will go. So when that came about, some of them were just like as if it changed the whole language in the trade.
I think we'll add that to our stories as well.
And then when it came to it on computers, later on at the trading and now, like, well, I know one chap that still works at the grain exchange, or he spends his day. I remember his dad. Remember when he started, I mean, he's in his 60s or 70s now. And he got through the metric system, but the computers, he thought that was crazy at all. Working out now, just out of a screen. And that just changes it all. And then there were limits to trading in grain, which there are now not today. That's what's causing all the bloody problems.
Limits to trading?
Certain hours to trade. Only certain limits to the trading. What has happened in the United States is that because of the... They had... The stock market was at certain times. Then they opened it, that's their business, to people overseas with different times, the Japanese, and then the California, the trade. You can't have a trade like that. So there was more of a trade outside of the hours. There was trading outside the hours,
mm-hmm.
And they put it in the morning. And what happened, like with as I get it in the mortgage, you get NBC in that night in the paper, and they just read what's in front of them. And so people that were in the stock market, legitimate traders in that, wanted to get into another trade in the last few years. So they got into the grain trade and the merger of Chicago. These had no... So limits have been removed. And suddenly you hear, you know, that the price of corn is going up to this time. And they say, well, because of the corn they're making, ethanol and everything else like that. And this is the type of stories they put out. The corn is grown because people have cattle that they want to feed. They're not going to make ethanol out of it. And the other corn is going because of Shenley's and Hiram Walker's need the corn. Certainly some will go for ethanol, but the ethanol is not going to replace the gasoline or some other things. So these fellows got now in the grain market taking big positions, driving the price of the grain up. But they don't have grain to deliver. They were never in the grain trade. They've literally moved the regulations. But
so the implications of that in the long term, if...
Yeah, but you see, like the mortgage thing. People that were in a mortgage, lending a mortgage, and didn't have money themselves, then when they got a mortgage signed, they would go to the next step. How could CIBC, for example, in Canada, here our banks are all controlled by the government, the Bank of Canada, how could the CIBC have a deficit on that field of $800 million? Who can, in a firm, lend out money to somebody without really an in-depth check? Look at what they lost with the firm in Texas.
So the danger of unlimited markets then grain can possibly come home to roost in not a very positive fashion.
Yeah, well, we're not badly affected. See, they bought out the Winnipeg Grain Exchange, an American firm.
Removing it farther from the producer or the source of production.
Yeah, for it, they have a whole different approach. But
we'll wait and see.
We'll wait and see that. I have no...
One last question for today. Thinking back now just to your work in the wheat board, what might surprise people most about the work that you did? People that aren't in the know, what might surprise them most about what you did in your career?
I'd have to give it some thought. All I know, it was exciting, and that I had a lot of...
Exciting in what way?
It was a new day all the time, a learning. And I met a lot of people, a lot of good people, and... Jesus, in trades, I would look at them and how they did that. I mean,
in trades.
Some just by chance and everything. So on the plane, I made many trips on short notice and go. So on a trip, a gentleman I got into a conversation with. He was a Romanian and very young. He went when the Spanish Civil War was on. So he with others. So when people got killed, they took the arms that were there, have the arms fixed up, and then they would sell them and do other things. He became an arms dealer, a major one. You hear about these people. So the last major job he had was with Sukarno. We met on the plane and we discussed the music and other things like that. So he'd retired in Paris. He loved Paris more, to hear them talk the French, their language. So he said he would go. I told him the same with me, it just flows out of him. So he would go to courthouses. He enjoyed that as much as an argument. Or some a car hit the other on the corner, that or there. To hear them get out and really it just sensational to hear them. And so he liked Paris. His wife had passed away. He had a son who was a symphony conductor in Switzerland. So, and he had sort of retired at the trade. When there was a war between Iraq and Iran, Saudi Arabia put up a pile of money to pay for arms. But before you pay for arms, you want to make sure you're getting your money. So they hired him. He had a staff of about 14 people. They were literally retired. One was in Western Canada and British Columbia. Anyways, he got them together. And they supervised that with this big trade. And what they got, each one of them got at least $1 million when it was over. To all was delivered in an ordered one.
So you met some fascinating people not related to the grain trade.
So, Jesus, how old are they? So we always kept in very good terms and with him. He was a remarkable individual.
You met?
Then he... Oh, Jesus, a mind on him like a Swiss one. I was a very famous arms dealer in Holland that he dealt with. And he went to Holland and he saw... Oh, yeah, there was... this is how it started. A chap that was working for him, an arms dealer, that was going to North Africa, and then the Congo. And the chap said he needed $50,000. And he gave him $50,000, and the chap gave him a painting to hold as collateral. The chap got killed in a car accident. The painting was a classic, worth millions. So from that he went to the... He had a Van Gogh that had never been... knowing him, he was okay. He contacted this arms dealer in Holland, who the appropriate people in the government were. He went to see them. He had nice people. He had lunch with them and the lunch, and they came to see him in Paris and this and that. They agreed. He agreed to give them the painting. It's in the Van Gogh Museum, with an inscription to the donated by his wife's memory. Mm. They then allowed him to deposit money in Holland banks and not pay any taxes in Holland for his son and his himself.
A good deal if you can get it.
Oh, the painting was worth enough. But they made a copy, an identical of the copy. He said they can't be identical, they're small, of the painting, because he loved it. They had it in this room. So once he'd asked me about my trip. So once at a time, and I'd have to go, like the schedule, I'd fly to New York with chaps from the office, meet for breakfast Friday, two guys, different grain traders that traveled in Central America. And then on the Monday, we'd fly to the Santo Domingo, the Dominican Republic. We'd there a day and a half, then to Venezuela. Then we'd go to Panama. Then we'd go to...
And what would be in each of those places?
Flour mills.
Ah.
Meeting people that were potential to even quantities. So I told him about that one. So we'd meet various people like that, but you often wonder who's got the money to pay for the screen at these places. So I get calls in those towns, or in the hotel I was, from somebody that is asked, could you tell me who was at the meeting? I'd say, oh. And then one guy would say, well, this fellow has the authority. They knew up to Costa Rica, and we come back. And so even from Paris, he knew people that didn't know people, the trade, and a phenomenal individual.
So this fellow who was the arms runner knew the players, the money people in other countries.
Because it's a second-hand trade. When you sell new ones, they trade them in these other places. Oh.
A small world.
Huh?
Yeah, a small world. So when you said
But on the plane, we got into all kinds of... but never on that, that's only later.
Yeah. So when you said that you met other people in the trades... that you marveled at what they did within the grain trade?
Yeah, some particularly in shipping and transportation, and ocean shipping and
Say more about that.
I was at the Maritime Commission when we were selling these ships. So they had ships to Canadian people. So they covered so many, but there were ships left. So Greek owners were interested. They opened 49 companies named in Maritime Center. But one day this man came at the commission, wants to see my boss. My boss was at the dentist with the lady. I started to get into a conversation. He asked me what I did, and I said, told him. He said he was in shipping. I asked him about rates for 6 months, time charter, voyage charters, and that. This was Mr. Levanos. He had a son, two daughters. One, Onassis, married one of the daughters, and Niarchos married the other, the two people. But Levanos, they were over 100 years in shipping. So he had vessels. Oh, and so I didn't know till subsequently when I was in Montreal. A very good friend of mine was a stevedore and did the vessel, knew Mr. Levanos. And anyways, from a conversation, next time he came, he gave me a recording. We had talked about music and about other things like that. And so in how these people, a whole fleet of that size, and to keep track. But I could see the continuity, the people that he hired for doing the chartering of the vessels. And then who was in the port looking after his crew. I mean, it's essential of the crew. Find a dentist for them, a doctor for them, and their personal mail, or things like that.
So these foreign companies set up some really strong alliances with... agents and such.
Oh, yeah, an agent.
In Canadian.
But certain ones, huh? Yeah, yeah. It's very quiet and that deceived, but... they're just fascinated, these people. And then, other than their business, they have quite a...
They have lives.
Yeah. So...
Okay. I think we'll call it for today.
Okay.
And thank you very much. This has been great.